Hello. First, I'd like to thank Alina, all the student organizers and the Department of Education for allowing me to speak here today and hosting this very interesting conference. It's great so far, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the day and learning more from many of you. My name is Brendan Munhall, and I'm a student at Stockholm University. This presentation is based on research that I did for a course in the master's program that I'm in, International and Comparative Education. And I've done most of this research on secondary sources, well, all of it on secondary sources. So I don't have any firm answers to some of the topics I bring up, but I think it'll be an interesting platform for discussion. And hopefully we can have a short discussion afterwards. Nepal, as we've mentioned a few times so far in this conference, it's a country landlocked between China and India. There are three main regions. There are the mountains, the hills region, and the plains. There's a population of over 26 million. And Nepal has an entrenched caste system, which is very important to understand if you're going to be looking at this country. There are 125 different castes and ethnic groups, and 123 different languages spoken. Nepal has a serious problem with child marriage, and 41% of girls are married before the age of 18, and 10% are married before the age of 15, and they're often in abusive relationships. Nepal suffered a civil war between 1996 and 2006, and it's something that they are still recovering from today. The education system of Nepal is, there are five distinct levels. Pre-primary, primary, lower secondary, upper secondary, and post-secondary. The major problems in 2015 were illiteracy, non-enrollment, and school dropout. And this is most pronounced in marginalized groups such as region, caste, or gender. People under the age of 24, those in remote areas, girls, ethnic minorities, and lower castes, and the poor, are extremely disadvantaged in terms of educational attainment. Now, SDG4 includes these seven indicators and the A, B, and C as well, which are not on the slide. But for the purposes of this discussion, I want to look at three. 4.1 relates to universal and quality education. 4.5 relates to gender disparities. And 4.6 looks at literacy. So the following few slides are national averages for indicators and targets for the coming 15 years in Nepal. The most basic of indicators says that children should get access to education, quality education. The level of students reaching grade 8 who are enrolled in grade 1 is 74.6%, with girls slightly higher. As a national average, girls are doing proportionally better, but nearly 25% are dropping out. In terms of the gender parity index, the GPI, is a socioeconomic index usually designed to measure the relative access to education of males and females. As can be seen here, women over 15 struggle to have the same access to education as men. This has been addressed with girls in primary and secondary, having far better access and being nearly equal. But what the third number shows is the difficulty women face after secondary. This indicator, 4.6, demonstrates a sizable gap in literacy between men and women, women being 9% less literate under the age of 24 and even further behind at older ages. Now, this isn't SDG4, so not the topic of our conference here, but it is related to the achievement that girls face. SDG5 is related to gender equality, and this plays a huge role in the girls' ability to achieve in school. fact that girls under 19 are married at a rate of 24.5% across the country demonstrates the interconnectivity and influence of each of these indicators on each other, and each of them cannot be considered in isolation. So, access to school is incredibly dependent on wealth, and many development programs are based on providing scholarships to poor girls. These early problems, among others, manifest later in life, with the poorest women attending secondary much less. Now, a combination of social and access barriers are greatly limiting to transitioning to secondary opportunities. Lower castes, such as the Dalit or Madhisi, living in rural regions, have much lower scores on national tests. While the national literacy rate has increased to 65.9, there remains a large gap between men and women. The gender gap, though it is decreasing, is still noticeable across the entire country, and most notable in remote regions. This table shows the differences between men and women and in already marginalized communities. So those who have never attended, girls are 21% higher. Past attended, 14% lower, and current attendance, 7% lower. And only 40% of the Dalit under 25 attended school in 2011, far below the national average. So all of this results in a situation where primary age girls, simply put, are attending school less and given fewer opportunities. Later in life, these numbers get worse. Now, there are a number of ongoing development programs, has been over the last few years, and I just picked a couple examples just to kind of show what kind of work's being done and relating them to one of the indicators in SDG 4. So relating to universal and quality education, the Nepali Children's Education Project's goal is to enroll children in comprehensive scholarship programs. The cost of attending school is prohibitive to many, so this organization covers tuition and essential costs and provides a support network, mostly for girls. UNICEF has a program called the Out of School Children Initiative, and they aim to reduce the number of children who are out of school by developing a profile of excluded children, determining the barriers that cause exclusion, and implement policies that address this exclusion. The majority of barriers are facing girls. And finally, Save the Children and World Vision have a program called Literacy Boost. This is meant to improve the literacy skills of children and improve opportunities and open doors. And it focuses on boosting those that are most marginalized, which is, for example, girls. So this is the state of education in 2015. But as we know, in April in 2015, there was an earthquake. So in the earthquake, nearly 7,000 schools were destroyed. 1 million children were without classrooms, and another 500,000 had only limited access. Over 3,300 schools were in severely affected areas, and over 14,500 classrooms were destroyed. Some schools were able to be reopened, but most needed reconstruction, which is still an ongoing process. Temporary learning centers were established to promote student learning or students returning to school. And a survey of 1,800 students found that almost 100 wished to go back to school immediately, central to SDG 4. The earthquakes did not affect the population of Nepal uniformly, with the entrenched caste system and gender norms. In the severely affected districts of Gorkhu, Sindhupalchok, and Nuwakot, which I'm not sure I'm pronouncing right, more than 90% of schools were destroyed, and 80% of schools were destroyed in Dading. The homes of Dalits represent 41% of all the schools, or of all the homes that are damaged. Now, reports have been critical of the international community's response to the 2015 earthquakes. There have been promises of financial support, but much of it has not reached Nepalis in need. Vulnerable groups are susceptible to exploitation, as corruption has been said to be a major problem. Now, today, this is about 1.5 years later, there are over 26,000 people displaced, still living in camps. The government has finalized school designs based on their national building code, and they should be earthquake-proof and disaster-resilient. But unfortunately, the designs are too costly, and many development and humanitarian agencies have adapted them to lower costs, so they might even be lower quality. And as of now, large-scale construction has not yet begun. Many of the temporary learning centers have been handed over to the community, giving some sort of permanence, but unfortunately they do not have sufficient materials or classrooms or bathroom facilities. And there are further efforts to winterize and provide warm clothing. Now, what are the specific effects on girls? There's been a rise in trafficking due to disrupted communities, and it puts girls at physical risk. Between April 2015 and February 2016, there were a total of 850 children intercepted by police being trafficked. And that's an average of 89 children each month. Those are just the ones that were caught. Children are in need of psychological support. Teachers are receiving training, but their resources are limited and training is limited. There's an increased need for child-friendly spaces, such as schools, for monitoring mental health and safety. Over 4,400 damaged toilets, water, sanitation, and hygiene facilities in schools. Girls who are menstruating are less likely to attend class. It's a challenge to completing their education. So this is major, major barrier for them. And a report from Save the Children quotes two girls from two different districts and said they were worried about not being able to return to school because of the increased burden of domestic chores since the earthquake. Marginalized castes have far lower attendance rates, citing increased responsibilities as the main reason. So it's too early to see the specific effects, but from history and similar cases, we can predict that this will negatively affect the already marginalized girls. The degree that this is going to affect them is to be determined, to be seen, but it's something that will be interesting to study and important to addressing the needs of these girls. Now, the humanitarian response, it was swift, and there are a number of organizations involved there already. Many that were involved before have shifted towards humanitarian concerns. And I picked three examples just as to understand what's being done. Oxfam, they've reconstructed a bathroom located in one of their schools. This is central to the initiative. This initiative is central to the belief that protecting girls and their needs is important. An organization called Conscious Impact have developed a school construction plan and a process for building bricks. Their locally based and sustainable procedure give locals autonomy. And Save the Children have established over 60 child-friendly spaces hosting over 6,000 children. Activities there are based on gender and encourage students to interact with each other. And the Nepali government has updated its disaster risk plan to better react to any further crisis. Now, in conclusion, I want to introduce a very interesting concept about the intersection between humanitarian and development aid and how they can conflict. Development programs are slow-moving initiatives designed to steer countries towards SDG goals. A disaster brings an immediate need for certain basic human rights, such as healthcare, food, shelter. But this shift can put certain initiatives on the back burner. Education, for example, can be deprioritized, retreating development work, and limiting access to already marginalized groups. Maureen Fordham describes this as The Tyranny of the Urgent. Fordham says, in the face of disaster, local development programs, often with gender-focused initiatives, are made a second priority, returning society to more traditional norms. In the aftermath of the Nepal earthquakes, and its already problematic gender equality in education, girls can fall further behind, and that's a real danger. So rather than solve this right now, and since this is kind of a research assignment for a course, I haven't been able to research there, but that's something I would like to do in the future. But maybe now it's something we could use kind of a platform to discuss these topics, specific or in general, and I'd like to hear your comments. I have a question here we could use to kind of launch from. With already disadvantaged groups, how can the international community prioritize immediate and effective disaster response while also prioritizing education development initiatives? So I'd be very interested to hear what you think.
Thank you. I actually was in Nepal at the time of the earthquake, volunteering for an NGO that works with education. And I mean, I suppose that it's a big difference whether you're, I was in Kathmandu. So I guess it's a big difference whether you're in the city or whether you're outside of the city, especially for Sindhupalchak and all these areas where the, you know, the scale of destruction was worse than in Kathmandu. I mean, there were areas in Kathmandu as well that were severely damaged. But at least if you look at it from, and let, I would like to point out that I don't speak Nepali, so I was, you know, kind of, my information that I got was from my local NGO, as well as the English-speaking media, whatever we had, but there was a very strong emphasis on education, at least in the Kathmandu area. There was a very strong emphasis on about supporting children to go to school, supporting these child-friendly learning spaces, in which my organization was also involved in. And I actually found it very encouraging to see that this was something that the government, which may not always be very effective, I'll leave my personal opinions about the government for something a little bit later, but I think there was a definite emphasis on the education, which I found a very encouraging sign for looking from, you know, this point of view. Now, the question is, how do you, like, I don't know if you're the right person to answer this, but I'm kind of I'm just wondering, like, how, to what extent can you support this kind of work, like supporting education, because they had a lot of strong emphasis also on the fact that this is very important for kind of overcoming the trauma and giving children the tools to actually overcome the situation. But how does this interplay with, you know, kind of the reconstruction efforts and everything? People won't have the energy. If they're building their homes, they're not going to have the energy to actually put children in school, which is quite understandable. And I think I don't have answers. That was just something that I kind of had when I left, that how does this interplay work? And at what point, like, how do you fit in humanitarian work and then the development? Because there seems to be a gap between those two. And how do you bridge that gap? Because you cannot use those development funds for humanitarian causes. And then for humanitarian causes, even though there has been a call for humanitarian funds in education, this has not really happened. So from your opinion, how would you kind of look at this issue?
Well,
I'm sorry, it's a very difficult question.
It is hard to say. And I might just kind of ask a question to kind of answer it, I think, or maybe just pose another query. I think it's really interesting that NGOs have a real separation between the humanitarian and development programs, and the funding is often quite different. So you can see how it can be difficult for them to work together, and they can often conflict with each other. So I don't have an answer to it, but I think maybe that needs to be looked at a bit more closely and see that they operate a bit closer and more of a united approach.
So I think small comment. Thank you very much about the presentation, and I think especially when the disaster is really on top and when it's life saving, it is life saving in that state certainly. But in case and when there is always a bit prolonging situation, and especially when there is the kind of recovery that starts fast, I think there is any way the education have, I mean, there are several ways to react quickly. We have the schools in the camps, we have schools in the kind of shelters and all those, but in the same way, of course, depending what kind of disaster, is it a man-made or natural, but especially if that is a man-made and conflict, there is very often, of course, this middle and longer term things, what you can develop and reconstruct in the same way. Meanwhile, the schools in the shelters or tents is going on, but then you can kind of just look there, also kind of the opening and not losing the good crises. It is hard to say, but anyway, there can be also place to check the ways of teaching, who will be involved for the school or for the education, and how the curricula is done and all these things. So it is also opening space very often. So in a longer term and in a middle way, in the same time, you can work in different levels. So you can work already in the schools and all this, but in the same way with the government, with the agencies, and with the possible funding, because normally, in normal situation, you probably don't have funds for education, but now it is coming more for the country sometimes. That seems maybe now a bit cynical for, I don't know, but anyway, then you can also take advantage, and it is good for, in a longer term, that it is the education sector also can kind of be reshaped or developed in the same way, because it is shaped already. So there are also kind of advantages, even the disaster has been heavy, but also, there can be also advantages in this, so if you work with it.
Thank you. Yeah, very interesting. Something I was thinking when you know, the first question was that your experience is that education was really prioritized in the community, and from what I've read in different reports from organizations is that nationwide, there has been a good response, but it's the hardest to reach that have been suffering the most, and they're the ones who are already far furthest behind. And the girls, especially there, they're in real danger in the future. So I think for future development, I think the humanitarian response is essential to building a platform for these girls to have the tools they need to be able to achieve and be successful in life. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. I've been thinking about it a lot, and I thought about yesterday when the panel was discussing, and what bothers me a lot when we take this, let's say, you know, condescending way that we take this Western viewpoint of education, that we start immediately thinking about schools. But who says that education needs to happen in a school? We can do a rebuilding of any humanitarian things or buildings, and at the while we can learn about building, we can learn about whatever, mathematics, if we need to think about subjects, or we can learn communication, we can learn cooperation. I think the colonized way of thinking education, like when we discuss about Asian culture or Asian countries and African countries, that we need to go there and show them how to educate themselves properly is kind of, because like if you think about Paulo Freire, who thought that when we educate people from colonized places, we should cooperate with them and offer them tools to build themselves, their educational system, and on their culture and stuff like that. So on this, I think we could look at their culture and think about other ways to educate them and teach them to, or cooperate them to be able to, so they can, while they are rebuilding their community, also think about education as a process rather than something that you need to be done systematically in a way that now we can give in the end, we can give, let's say, evaluate what we've done. That is not needed in the education field when we are talking about people in foreign countries.
Yes, that's very interesting, and it's very true. I think our way isn't the only way. I think there's a lot of different approaches you can take to education, and it's good to be self-critical. There's a lot to be learned from indigenous communities and towards sustainability, and I think that would be good for all of us to learn about how to appreciate those kind of things from those kind of communities. Anyone else? Maybe last one.
Thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. I just wanted to add that it's very encouraging that this year the government of Nepal is approving the education plan for the next 5 years. And for the first time, for example, now they have an equity plan and equity strategy included in that national plan, which hopefully means that now in a way we might be able to prevent some of what happened in the earthquake, as you mentioned, that always those that are the poorest and with the weakest buildings and furthest away suffer the most. So hopefully in Nepal certain actions can now take place that would then help that in the next upcoming disasters, people might be stronger to resist and survive, even in the remote areas.
Absolutely, that would be a wonderful thing to be accomplished in Nepal, and maybe by 2030 they'll accomplish it. That would be great. So thank you for listening. And I'll give the floor to the next speaker.